This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A tense standoff continues in Lima, Peru, at the residence of the Japanese ambassador. An unknown number of leftist guerrillas are holding several hundred hostages, among them two members of Peru's cabinet, the president of its Supreme Court, and at least a dozen foreign ambassadors. There are unconfirmed reports that a handful of American diplomats are being held as well. The rebels, who belong to the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, are demanding the release of members of their group who are in prison. They took over the residence last night during a party in honor of Japanese Emperor Akihito's birthday. Joining us now from Lima is reporter Eric Lyman. And Eric, you've been outside the residence. What does it look like?
Well, most of the crowds and the reporters on hand are being kept about two blocks away from the residence. The police on the scene are fearing that there may be a bomb explosion or some gunplay. There was an explosion earlier this morning, and their main concern is making sure that none of the spectators or the reporters outside get hurt should that happen.
The rebels had threatened to start killing some of the hostages. They set a deadline. Deadline came and went. Does that mean that there are productive negotiations going underway with the government?
Well, that's the implication, but we really haven't had any confirmation of that. The deadline was set at 12:15 local time, which is the same as Eastern time in the U.S., and that came and went. It was a very, very tense moment. The door opened up, and they actually released at least three hostages at that point. We're not quite sure why they did that, but we do know for a fact that nobody was killed, and for the most part, the situation has remained unchanged since then.
Now, I gather the rebels have been talking to the local media there. What have they been saying?
Well, actually, the communication between the rebels and the local media has been surprisingly sparse. They released a tape to the government early this morning. Only part of the content of that tape has been released to the media. They also allowed the Japanese ambassador to communicate with some media in Japan, but only in Spanish so that they could understand what was being said. And for the most part, they've communicated their demands. They've reiterated their promise to kill all of the hostages if their demands aren't met, and that's pretty much it.
Now, give us a sense of the best that you've been able to do in figuring out how many guerrillas and how many hostages there actually are in there.
Well, the range we've heard for the number of guerrillas is around 20 to 25. Most of the people who were released last night, the rebels, right after they took over, released a lot of women and elderly people. Most of those people said about two dozen rebels were in there. We don't have an exact number, but I think 20 to 25 is probably a pretty safe bet.
And hostages?
Now, the number of
I'm asking.
Well, the number of hostages is much more difficult to estimate. The Army said this morning that there were about 200 to 210, but one of the hostages who was released this afternoon said that number might have been closer to 500. The number he used was 490. And the compound is just so large and sprawling that it's very, very difficult to estimate. There were some 800 people who were invited to the party, but a lot of them didn't show up. So we don't know. President Fujimori, for example, was one of the invitees and didn't show up.
And just once again, take us through how this began, because the origins, it seems to be something out of a cheap movie, how the guerrillas managed to get into the party.
Now, this is pretty much the modus operandi for the MRTA terrorists. They're known for their urban warfare techniques. They're known as kidnappers and not as as violent confrontationalists the way the Shining Path Peru's bigger terrorist group is known to be. Now, about one year ago, the MRTA was foiled in an attempt to take over Congress, posing as journalists, and that was noteworthy because an American woman, Lori Berenson, was arrested and as part of that foiled attempt. So their standard operating procedure is pretty much to pose as something else.
And this time they posed actually as waiters, I gather, at the party. Eric Lyman, thank you very much. Eric Lyman speaking to us from Lima, Peru.
The United States condemned the hostage taking in Peru today, with the State Department calling it a shameful act of violence and terrorism. President Clinton offered American help in resolving the situation, though the White House is emphasizing that the Peruvian government is responsible for handling the crisis. Earlier this year, the State Department's Counterterrorism Office reported that the strength of the Tupac Amaru movement had greatly diminished in recent years. But today, U.S. officials called the guerrillas terrorists and urged Peru not to give in to their demands. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
According to the State Department, U.S. Ambassador Dennis Jett and his deputy chief of mission were both at the reception at the residence of the Japanese ambassador, but left about a half hour before the guerrillas entered. Two women who were held hostage and then released said today that as many as seven Americans are still being held at the residence, among them reportedly four officials of the U.S. Agency for International Development, the AID. The State Department will not confirm the presence of U.S. citizens among the hostages, saying it doesn't want to give the guerrillas more information about their captives. At the State Department today, spokesman Nick Burns urged the Peruvian government not to give in to the hostage takers.
The United States does not make concessions to terrorists, and we encourage others to follow that practice as well. Now, obviously, in a situation like this, where a great number of people are being held hostage, hundreds of people, innocent people, all of them being held hostage, it's obviously prudent for the Peruvian government to have some contact with the hostage takers, and I believe that they've had some sporadic contact, but our general policy is this: terrorists should not be rewarded for their crimes. Terrorists should not succeed in their crimes. And our policy is we don't make concessions. And that's our very strong advice to foreign governments.
Advice is about all the United States can offer for now. As the host country, responsibility for resolving the hostage crisis lies squarely with Peru. The United States is just one of many countries affected by the events. Among the hostages are ambassadors from at least a dozen countries, and several of their governments today urged that Peru show restraint in dealing with the hostage takers. A spokesman for the Japanese embassy in London today urged moderation.
We would like all the efforts to secure the safety of the hostages first. I think we are very concerned. All we wish is the prompt release of the hostages and for all the people concerned to exert all their efforts to free their hostages.
If U.S. officials are among those being held at the residence, it would be the first time U.S. diplomats have been taken hostage in more than 10 years. In Latin America, hostage taking is an established tradition. The incident in Lima is reminiscent of one in Managua, Nicaragua in 1974. Sandinista revolutionaries that year raided a Christmas party and held people there hostage until the Nicaraguan government agreed to release imprisoned Sandinista leaders, among them Daniel Ortega, who went on to lead the Sandinistas to power in 1979. Tupac Amaru is smaller and less well-known than the other major guerrilla group in Peru, Sendero Luminoso, or Shining Path, which has attacked aid workers, missionaries, and other foreigners working in Peru. Cynthia McClintock is an expert on Tupac Amaru at George Washington University.
In the past, they have not been a bloodthirsty group. And again, the contrast is made to Sendero, which saw murder as just one other part of its arsenal. By contrast, Tupac Amaru has generally sought a variety of ways to achieve its goals, and there have not been many civilian deaths attributed to it.
The group has, however, staged spectacular actions before, such as when they rented a house near where one of their leaders was being held and then dug a tunnel in and freed him. State Department spokesman Nick Burns says Tupac Amaru is well known to the United States.
This group attacked the American Embassy in Lima in 1990 during the Gulf War with a rocket-propelled grenade. We know this group. Obviously, we have been doing what we can throughout the last decade to use our influence along with the Peruvian government to try to shut this group down.
The Tupac Amaru guerrillas at the Japanese ambassador's house are threatening to kill their hostages if their demands are not met. Cynthia McClintock says she thinks the guerrillas are counting on violence not being necessary.
My guess is that they would much prefer a situation in which they can sit down at the table with the Fujimori government and bargain for the release of prisoners, bargain for highlighting other demands that they have. But the question is whether the Fujimori government will feel that that is a viable strategy, given that it, for its part, has made and achieved a lot of its popular support on the basis of having, quote, defeated terrorism.
With so many diplomats being held hostage, the Peruvian government may not feel free to decide its own policy in Lima. U.S. officials think the guerrillas chose deliberately to target a diplomatic event in order to internationalize the situation. I'm Tom Gelton in Washington.
Hostage taking falls into the spectrum of terrorist acts along with bombing and hijacking that enable the powerless to exult in their power and reduce the powerful to paralysis.
News analyst Daniel Shore.
That is what terror, the poor man's nuclear bomb, is all about. The first hostage-taking episode I remember was in West Germany in 1975 when the radical Baader-Meinhof gang kidnapped a politician and held him hostage for the release of five of their imprisoned comrades. The gang forced German television to show each prisoner boarding a plane and to broadcast a dictated propaganda statement. The Iranian guerrillas who took American embassy personnel hostage in 1979 succeeded probably beyond their wildest dreams. They dangled President Carter, the hated friend of the Shah, at the end of a string while America celebrated the young militants with a nightly ABC television show titled America Held Hostage, Warren Christopher. President Reagan, greeting the returned hostages, dramatically warned of swift and effective retribution for any such act in the future. Then he bartered missiles to Iran for a couple of the American hostages being held by pro-Iranian terrorists in Lebanon. It was, in fact, only President Bush who really held firm against hostage-taking. After the invasion of Kuwait, Saddam Hussein rounded up the Westerners living in Iraq as hostages against an American bombing. Bush threatened bombing if they were not released, even against the locations where they were being held. The hostages were freed. But in the recent history of dealing with hostage takers, that stands out. The greatest weapon the terrorists have is that they can match contempt for life against establishment leaders who, for reasons of sentiment or electoral politics, are terrified at the prospect of losing their citizens. So yesterday, Lebanon, today, Peru, tomorrow, who knows? The Cold War over, we do not have massive armies to fear, only the desperados, the fanatics, the terrorists. This is Daniel Shore.
This is All Things Considered. This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The man designated to be the next Secretary General of the United Nations accepted congratulations from around the world today. Yesterday, the UN General Assembly confirmed Kofi Annan of Ghana to replace Egyptian diplomat Boutros Boutros-Ghali. The United States blocked a second term for Boutros-Ghali, prompting a bitter fight to replace him with another African. At a UN news conference today, Annan pledged to work with the U.S., but urged Washington to pay its bills. NPR's Ann Cooper has more.
One important subtext to the Secretary General race was the United States and its considerable debts to the UN, now running at more than $1 billion. The Clinton administration's opposition to Boutros-Ghali was based on the belief that if he departed, Congress might finally pay the bills. Today, Kofi Annan urged the U.S. to do so, and quickly.
It is not really in the interest of the U.S. not to pay its contribution to the UN. It offends friends and foes alike. And the U.S. needs the UN, and UN needs the U.S., and we cannot operate effectively and efficiently without sound financial basis.
Annan will need more than gentle persuasion, though, to get the U.S. paying again. UN critics on Capitol Hill say they welcome his selection, but want to see his reform agenda before sending money. Annan doesn't take office until January, and so far he hasn't offered any specifics on change. But today he promised a fundamental review of the UN's purposes.
We, the member states of this organization, should begin to discuss what should the UN be doing, what should our business be, what should be our objectives, how do we reposition the United Nations as we move into the 21st century.
What kind of mandate would satisfy the critics in Congress isn't entirely clear. Some defenders of the UN say conservative Republicans won't be happy until the UN disappears, perhaps done in by the U.S.-induced financial crisis. But critics in Congress say it isn't the UN per se that's a problem. It's bad management that's let the international body grow out of control taking on tasks it has no business doing. Kofi Annan takes office well aware that U.S. critics expect the Secretary General to be a tough administrator and manager.
That is an essential part of the work, but he also has a political and diplomatic role, and above all, a moral voice which should be heard periodically when necessary.
Annan will be the first Secretary General from Sub-Saharan Africa, a region whose troublesome conflicts have often defied UN mediation and peacekeeping efforts. A 30-year veteran of the UN, Annan was chief of its peacekeeping operations when the Security Council selected him to replace Boutros Ghali. Despite the failures of some high-profile missions, Annan has maintained his reputation as an honest, efficient manager, perhaps because he is willing to reflect publicly on why peacekeeping hasn't always worked.
We've learned that, and I think the Council also, that a clear mandate is necessary. We have learned that the resources must be commensurate to the tasks.
The top UN job is rotated among continents, with each getting 2 5-year terms. Boutros Ghali served half of Africa's term. Annan, who will serve the second half, indicated today he would not try to seek another term. I'm Ann Cooper in New York.
Robert Adams is dead at the age of 81. He was a founding editor of the first Norton Anthology of English Literature, and that was not the only text of his to pass into the hands and minds of college students. His Norton translations of Voltaire's Candide and Machiavelli's The Prince were also standard texts. Donald Lamb is chairman of W.W. Norton & Company and worked with Robert Adams. We reached Mr. Lamb at his home in Santa Fe. Donald Lamb, do you think that Robert Adams is going to be remembered as a man whose weighty books were carried to class by 40 years worth of college students?
Well, he surely will be remembered as one of the great free-range intellectuals of our time. It didn't matter whether the work was in Latin or Italian or French. He was there to translate, to analyze, to annotate.
Some of the books that he published over the course of his career, they range from Milton to Joyce to Shakespeare, Stendhal. He is all over the place here.
Well, he surely was. At the same time, we are not talking here about a sober-sided pedant. In fact, he was something of a prankster. He once offered a course on the subject of metamorphosis, or change in literature, at Cornell University. In the closing minute of the last lecture of that course, a puff of smoke rose on the step of the on the stage of the lecture hall. When the smoke cleared, where Professor Adams had just stood, there was in his place a rooster.
The Norton Anthology of English Literature is surely one of the most universal texts for students to use in college. What was Robert Adams' contribution to it?
Well, he was the original editor of the 17th century section. That was the section that included the great metaphysical poets, included Milton, and of course some of the splendid prose writers of that century.
I understand that the section on John Donne was one of the first things that that Mr. Adams sent in for the anthology. I wonder if you could read to us from one of those selections.
Well, certainly the most memorable phrases ever written in prose by John Donne were in his 17th meditation. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb.
You're quite welcome.
Donald Lamb is the chairman of W.W. Norton & Company. He was a friend and the publisher of Robert Adams' work. He talked to us by telephone from his home in Santa Fe. Robert Adams, who was a teacher as well as a founding editor of the first Norton Anthology of English Literature, died on Monday at the age of 81.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. The career of Noel Coward is described in reference books with a long string of nouns: playwright, author, composer, songwriter, actor, singer, director, producer, nightclub entertainer. What's missing are the adjectives: witty, charming, urbane, sophisticated, decadent, perhaps. Noel Coward died in 1973. Now, almost a quarter century later, there's a Coward boom underway. Three books about him have just been published: a biography, a scholarly study, and a memoir by a longtime lover. And on Broadway, there's a successful revival of Coward's 1942 drawing room comedy Present Laughter. NPR's Susan Stamberg examines the current fascination with a man who was famous for much of the 20th century.
Whenever spring breaks through again, find my life.
A lot of people think Noel Coward is just too. Too elegant, too flippant, too soigné, just too. Tally up the details: this languid voice, all those silk dressing gowns, the carnation in the lapel, the constant cigarette dangled between his long, long second and third fingers. Slim face, high forehead, hair pomaded back just so, a perfectly groomed man, martini ready, primed to party.
Cocktails and laughter, but what comes after, nobody knows. You're weaving love into a mad jazz pattern, ruled by pantaloons. Poor little rich girl, don't drop a stitch too soon.
A romantic, glamorous world, Noel Coward. A world he created on paper first in 1924 in The Vortex, his first big hit. The author played the lead in a dressing gown. Having appeared that way in public, the public kept expecting it. But Philip Hoare, author of Noel Coward, a biography, says the real Coward was different.
Coward himself was an ordinary suburban boy from Teddington, London, a London suburb. And, his private life was entirely not like the sophisticated, cigarette-smoking, dressing-gown-wearing person. I mean, it became the bane of his life in a way, because, you know, he was always saying, oh, God, everyone thinks Noel Coward is so sophisticated. What would they think if they saw me go to bed with a little eggy something on a tray?
Eggies aside, Noel Coward was a trendsetter. He had enormous impact. Steve Ross, a pianist and singer who performs Coward's music, loved something one of the writer's pals said about his influence on society.
Until November of 1924, no one ever used the word darling except as a term of real endearment. And he was the first one. Now everybody in the world does hello, darling. I mean, it's a Lula Bankhead. Everybody uses it. I use it. But from what I gather, he changed the way people spoke.
Darling, divine, mad, cad.
He would heighten things. I mean, he would say, you know, I was clutching a teacup. You don't hold on to a teacup. You clutch it. He was heightened and dramatized our speech.
Is he too frivolous? After all, the apex of Noel Coward's career came between the two world wars. He got famous early, 1924, when he was just 25. And he stayed famous, funny, witty, urbane, the rest of it. But he twinkled and tinkled his piano through some terrible times.
I really admire Coward because he knew what he did well, and he did it well, and he wanted to do it, and he didn't make a lot of pretensions about trying to give the audience a message.
Actor Frank Langella. On Broadway, Langella is starring in a revival of Present Laughter, playing a middle-aged, super theatrical man of the theater who dives into various problems, fights, laughs. Coward created the role for himself, about himself, a most amusing man.
I think his feeling really was, if you want some kind of lesson or message, go to the library or get a book or watch a good documentary on the war. But if you want to have a good, light, easy, and very witty, entertaining time, come to one of my plays.
Oh! 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 glad, Daffy. Daffy, there's something awfully sad about happiness.
Actor Jeff Weiss, also in the cast of Present Laughter, sees something deeper than sheer entertainment in Noel Coward.
There's a great sense in all of his plays of lost chances and of the encroaching dark. In this play, it's about the fact that he's getting older and how difficult it is for him to sustain a relationship with an other, one person. He can sustain a relationship on some level with great many. Virtually everyone. He can charm the pants off the birds and the trees. But can he have one other?
That was a question for Noel Coward, too. Devoted to his mother and a small circle of friends, he had a series of affairs. Some lasted for several years. He was promiscuous, and he was homosexual, which in his day could be dangerous.
Homosexuality was illegal in England, and it wasn't up until 1966. So Coward was leading an illegitimate, illicit life. But it was something which also manifested itself in his work very much. I mean, there's a gay subtext to all of his plays, even the ones which deal most ostensibly with heterosexual relationships.
The current production of Present Laughter moves the subtext to center stage. In the past, directors have taken more of a wink-wink approach to the sexual proclivities of the leading character, the Coward character, Gary Essendine. But after studying the text, director Scott Elliott decided Gary should be openly, even exuberantly, bisexual. Lots of onstage flings with young lovelies, at least one of them male. Scott Elliott says his decision is controversial.
People will say, oh, you never should reveal it. You should never say that Noel Coward was gay. You know, I mean, but everybody knows it. And I thought, you know, instead of doing it as a kind of slam to him, I really did it as a tribute to him in the 90s.
Scott Elliott wants to make Noel Coward connect to today's audiences. Homosexuality is out of the closet now, and in this time of AIDS, singer Steve Ross says the new interest in Noel Coward, the show, the books, reflects a need.
More and more people are looking for positive role models, if you will, because a lot of the gay people in this country see sadness and connected with their lifestyle. So I think someone who can surmount that and do something with style, that's his gift, to do it stylishly and make people laugh.
My dogs and Englishmen go out to the midday sun, the Japanese don't care to, Chinese wouldn't care to, Hindus and Argentines sleep only from 12 to 1, but Englishmen detest us, yes. In the Philippines, they have lucky screens to protect you from the glare, and in the Malay States, there are hats like plates which the Britishers won't wear. At 12 noon, the natives swoon, and no further work is done, but my dogs and Englishmen go out to the midday sun.
Noel Coward's patter songs come right out of Gilbert and Sullivan, Steve Ross says. Ross, too, is in the cast of Present Laughter. He plays and sings Coward, Porter, and other tunes as the audience comes into the theater. Once the comedy begins, he becomes Frank Langella's long-suffering valet. Ross says one of Coward's best-known lyrics worked fine as light verse.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too developed for her age? I repeat, Mrs. Worthington, sweet Mrs. Worthington, don't put your daughter on the stage.
Life was a stage for Noel Coward. He theatricalized himself and made everyone around him part of his ongoing play. Frank Langella met Coward just once in the 1960s at a small private lunch in Hyannisport, arranged so the playwright, author, composer, performer could meet some fans, President and Mrs. Kennedy. Langella, just 24 years old then, says Coward dominated the afternoon with his charm.
I was all hair then. It was the Beatles time, so I was lots and lots of long hair. And he kept pushing me on, saying, I can't see your eyes. He sang all of his songs from Sail Away, which was the musical he was then doing in Boston. I remember how vulgar he was in the most delicious kind of way. You know, just within 10 minutes, every possible vulgarity you could think of, he said. And it was great, and he charmed everybody at the table.
Did you like him?
Yes, I liked him enormously. He was among the legendary people I have been really lucky enough to meet and spend time with in my life, that 5 or 6 hours I spent in his presence made me appreciate how close to what his legend was he was.
When the storm clouds are riding through a winter sky, sail away, sail away. When the love light is fading in your sweetheart's eye, sail away, sail away.
Noel Coward is a legend, wildly prolific, quick to create. A song in 7 minutes in a traffic jam in New York, a play in 4 days, laid up with flu in Shanghai. Decades of fame and fortune, success. In 1928, a year before he turned 30, Noel Coward wrote a show called Bittersweet, and for it, composed one of his most autobiographical songs. The haunting lyric ends with these words, "I believe that since my life began, the most I've had is just a talent to amuse." I'm Susan Stamberg.
We often report here about weapons, countries that buy and sell them, companies that make them. The arms trade seems to epitomize a profitable pragmatism, a zone of commerce that is devoid of patriotism or principle. Historian Lisa Jardine tells a story of one arms deal on which the history of the world may have hinged. She tells it in a very readable and elegantly produced new history of the Renaissance called Worldly Goods. Lisa Jardine's thesis is that merchants and business propelled knowledge throughout Europe. And to convey the sense of their view of enterprise, she relates the tale from the days when the Ottoman Turks were beating on the doors of Europe. They'd already conquered much of Byzantium, but not its capital, Constantinople.
A Hungarian gunsmith who, because of his access to copper and the raw materials of armaments in Hungary, had become expert at armament manufacture, came to the Byzantine emperor in Constantinople and offered to build him a gun so large and so powerful that no siege could withstand its onslaught.
Now we should explain here that the emperor in Constantinople at this point is the ruler of Eastern Christendom, and Turks are surrounding his domain at that point.
Indeed, he's beleaguered. He is the last bastion of the Christian church in the East. He is constantly appealing to the West to help him withstand repeated assaults from the Ottoman Empire, literally outside the walls of Constantinople. No one comes to his aid. The Hungarian gunsmith comes to his court and offers to build him this gun. Because the emperor Palaiologos, the emperor of the Byzantines, had neither commercial acumen nor technical know-how, he said he was very sorry, he didn't have the resources, this was not the kind of thing he was prepared to back. The gunsmith, who was simply a businessman, went from Constantinople to Adrianople, which was where Mehmed, the Ottoman emperor, had his seat, and he offered him the gun. Mehmed jumped at it. He had the gun built. He tested it by building himself a fort on the Bosphorus, from which he fired the gun at various passing ships, terrified the living daylights out of the Venetians. And he then wheeled the gun, which I think it involved dozens of oxen dragging it, wheeled it to the walls of Constantinople, and did indeed breach the walls of Constantinople with the super gun, terrified the inhabitants with the force of this gun, and the super gun purchased as a piece of cutting-edge new technology by the Ottomans in a piece of entrepreneurial selling by the Hungarians brought about the downfall of Constantinople in 1453.
What's captured there in part, when we think about the Hungarian gunsmith, is an attitude in the Renaissance that life is about business, and that if you can sell the gun to the Byzantines, you sell to them, and if they don't want it, you sell it to their enemies.
And, of course, armaments are the most dubious of areas. I would not be happy to be thought to be really extolling the virtues of armaments manufacturers who sell to both sides. But I think that what is at the heart of my revised view of the Renaissance is that there is something about the esprit and the energy and the acumen of the entrepreneurial businessman, which we ought to take seriously. That it's not that our own day is somehow falling into Philistinism when it uses the market as the sort of measure of achievement. It has always been thus in the West, that the drive of culture and civilization is commercial.
Historian Lisa Jardine is the author of Worldly Goods, A New History of the Renaissance.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A veteran FBI agent was arrested today on charges of spying for Russia. Earl Edwin Pitts was formally charged this afternoon in the U.S. District Court in Virginia. It's alleged that he sold U.S. secrets to Moscow for more than $200,000, starting as early as July 1987. FBI Director Louis Freeh said today that the agency is still trying to determine how much its security has been compromised. NPR's Chitraragavan reports.
The FBI launched an investigation codenamed False Flag 16 months ago, targeting Earl Edwin Pitts. They focused on Pitts partly because a cooperating witness incriminated him, partly because his wife, also an FBI employee, became suspicious and contacted the agency, and partly because of his access to top-secret information. An FBI affidavit unsealed in court today alleges that in 1987, Pitts became an agent of the SVRR, the intelligence service of the Russian Federation and direct successor of the KGB. FBI Director Louis Freeh said today that starting in August 1995, Pitts attempted to commit espionage through his contact with people he thought were SVRR agents, but were actually undercover FBI agents participating in the false flag investigation.
It is alleged that Pitts spied for Russian intelligence and later gave classified material to federal agents posing as Russian spies as part of a false flag operation. Pitts was arrested by FBI agents at 8:47 a.m. this morning at the FBI's training academy in Quantico, where he has most recently been assigned.
In January of 1987, Pitts moved from Alexandria, Virginia, to the New York field office, where, among other things, he conducted investigations concerning KGB officials assigned to the Soviet mission of the United Nations. U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District, Helen Fahey, said that's when Pitts's double life began.
In 1987, an official at the Soviet mission to the United Nations in New York City received a letter believed by the FBI to have been sent by Pitts. Pitts requested a meeting with the official who, at the time, was believed by FBI personnel to be a KGB officer. The official, who is now a cooperating witness in the government's investigation, met with Pitts in the New York City Public Library and turned Pitts over to Alexander Karpov, a high-level official with the KGB and later with the SVRR.
Fahey says Pitts wrote a letter to an undercover FBI agent last week in which he stated he had provided to the Russians everything he knew during the five-year period.
Nothing was sacred to Pitts. He was willing to betray his country, his agency, and his fellow agents. During the false flag operation, Pitts gave the undercover agents posing as SVRR officers sensitive and classified documents relating to the national defense, personal, medical, and family information about fellow FBI special agents who might be vulnerable to recruitment.
Fahey says a search of Pitts' computer showed he was developing an emergency escape plan for himself. Today, Earl Pitts, a slim, quiet man, appeared in court for a preliminary hearing wearing rumpled work clothes, a blue cotton shirt, and khaki pants. He was formally charged with conspiracy to commit espionage and attempted espionage. Both those charges carry a maximum penalty of life in prison or death. But Fahey said Pitts would not be eligible for the death penalty because there's no evidence that anyone died as a result of his actions and because no satellite systems or nuclear weaponry were involved. He'll be back in court Friday. I'm Chitraragavan in Washington.
The White House and the Democratic National Committee were still doing damage control today. 2 days ago, the Presidential Legal Expense Trust, the legal defense fund for President and Mrs. Clinton, announced it had rejected more than $600,000 in contributions raised by an old acquaintance of the Clintons. Charles Yalin Tri used to own a Chinese restaurant in Little Rock. Today, administration officials were researching how often Tri had visited the White House. Here to talk about Tree's rise within the Democratic Party is NPR's Peter Overby. Peter, when exactly did the staff of the President's Legal Defense Fund understand that they had a problem with Tree?
They understood it last March when Charlie Tree came into their office with two manila envelopes with $460,000 in checks and money orders. They didn't like the look of it. They hired investigators, and they eventually rejected all of the money. You can say that the screening system that the legal fund had set up worked as it should. Critics would say that this all should have come out before Election Day.
This man, Charlie Tri, he's been the president's friend for a considerable time.
That's true, but he's looking less like an old Little Rock buddy and more like a Washington operative. He's no longer in the restaurant business. He's in international trade. The DNC is looking into a $15,000 contribution of his from 1994. He said that he now thinks the contribution was illegal and it should be returned. But aside from that $15,000, he, his wife, his mother, and his companies, since 1992, have given Clinton and the Democrats more than $260,000.
So what, if anything, did he get for that generosity?
It's hard to know. The White House is still trying to figure out how many times he visited there. They haven't gotten an answer yet. The most recent time he visited was last week. There was a Christmas party. Supposedly about 250 people came. This was just a few days before the legal fund was going to announce that they had had a problem and sent back all the money he raised for them. But he was there on a list prepared by the DNC that had been submitted to the White House last October. He was also appointed by President Clinton to a commission on U.S. Pacific trade and investment policy. That goes back to the beginning of the year.
And it still, does this count for more than just a little rock businessman making good sort of trading on his acquaintanceship with the president?
Well, it's a glimpse into the stratospheric level of fundraising at the Democratic National Committee these days. Charlie Tri is a member of the DNC National Finance Board. To be on the National Finance Board, according to the DNC, you commit to raising or contributing $350,000 a year. To put this in monetary perspective, the Republican National Committee this year started offering what they called season tickets. You could be a season ticket holder if you put in $250,000 to the Republicans. That meant they would stop asking you for more money. The DNC National Finance Board is working at the $350,000 a year level. Besides Tri, the DNC won't say how many people are on the National Finance Board or who they are. But $350,000 a year over the 4 years that a president is in office is $1.4 million. And that is the level that Charlie Tri has been playing at.
Thanks very much. NPR's Peter Overby.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today, the ABC television network was instructed to pay $10 million to Alan Levan, chief executive of Bank Atlantic. Jurors in federal court in Miami decided Levan had been libeled by the network in a report on the program 2020, which aired 6 years ago. Levan said he hopes the decision will change the practices of network journalists. ABC has vowed to appeal. We have a report from NPR's Brooke Gladstone.
Reached today in his corporate offices, Alan Levan says he feels vindicated.
Yes, there are champagne corks popping.
He said the 2020 segment, reported by ABC correspondent John Stossel in 1991, damaged his reputation and caused him considerable pain. He said that, despite the claims of the defense, the case was not about press freedom, but about truth.
The fact is that they have the right to criticize issues and people, but they also have a responsibility to be balanced. And this was not a balanced story. It was not a true story. we've been able to right a wrong here.
Steve Pizzo is an investigative reporter and author of Inside Jobs, The Looting of America's Savings and Loans. He says white-collar crimes pose a particular problem for both prosecutors and journalists because they have to determine the intent of the alleged violator. In this case, Levan convinced his investors to swap real estate for bonds, which later lost much of their value. Was he intending to defraud, or was it honest error?
It's not like a street crime where you've got a person who hit somebody over the head and stole their wallet. The intent there was clear. In a bank fraud case, the intent becomes a very complicated thing to prove.
Actually, a court found in 1992 that Levan had, in fact, committed fraud, but the conviction was later erased as part of an $8 million settlement. So ABC was not allowed to discuss that earlier verdict. For legal purposes, it no longer existed. Floyd Abrams represented ABC in the libel case. Unquestionably, he says, the judge's decision to bar discussion of the earlier verdict made a big difference.
The fact is, another jury did make a decision. It did find that the Mr. Levan, who sued ABC and who won today, had committed securities fraud in the course of his conduct. And that matter, we think, should have come in front of this jury. And that will certainly be one of the matters which will be heard on appeal.
Abrams feels very confident about the appeal. He says some 70% of libel judgments against journalists are overturned on appeal. Abrams conceded that the 2020 program was flawed, and the network issued an apology for errors. For example, the program stated that Levan refused to be interviewed. That was untrue. But Abrams maintains that the story was essentially correct. Bruce Sanford is a libel lawyer. He says that journalists should be doing more, not less, reporting on these issues.
If journalists had done more enterprise reporting on thrift institutions in the 1980s, maybe we would not have had the SNL crisis. Maybe taxpayers would not have had to pay billions of dollars to bail out the failed and collapsed SNL.
But Sanford says a $10 billion penalty is bound to have a chilling effect on an increasingly corporate-owned news media. This is Brooke Gladstone reporting.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Many residents in the northern Plain State spent a day digging out from a three-day blizzard. The snow, the bitter cold temperatures, and the strong winds have sealed off roads and shut down schools and businesses from Minnesota and the Dakotas to Oklahoma. The winter storm is making its way across the country and is being felt all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Mark Zadalek of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Snowdrifts several feet high and wind chills of 50 to 60 degrees below zero shut down much of the Dakotas and western Minnesota over the past couple of days. Hundreds of miles of roads were buried in snow so deep, plow crews simply couldn't keep up. Karen Schaff is a cashier at the Petro Travel Center outside of Fargo, North Dakota. The truck stop sits at the junction of Interstates 94 and 29. Both roads have been closed. Chef says her parking lot is overflowing with rigs, and inside, she says it's truckers everywhere.
We're elbow to elbow out here, but they all seem to be getting along pretty well. We're selling a lot of hot drinks, coffee, hot chocolate. We're selling some personal items like soap and shampoo for those truckers who are going to, you know, kill some time in the shower.
National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Bellis says what's most unusual about this storm is just how much of the country it's affecting.
This is really probably the first good Arctic blast we've had that's really going to affect pretty much the whole country. You've got, I heard, winter storm watches as far south as New Orleans. And then, of course, I guess the Deep South is even preparing for a little bit of snow.
In Oklahoma, authorities say five people have been killed in weather-related traffic accidents. Texas is under a freeze warning. Snow is forecast for Alabama. And farmers in northern Florida have been warned to be on the lookout for snow. Forecasters say the Dakotas bore the brunt of the bitter cold winds and blowing snow. Don Byers was one of hundreds of truckers stranded in the Upper Plains. He had been fighting the storm for nearly 2 days. He finally pulled over yesterday.
You know, after a couple of days or so, it does begin to wear on you as far as you're spending money, not making money, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah, because your truck's running. I mean, you know, if you kill it in weather like this, you may or may not get it started. You know what I'm saying. And you're going to spend a certain amount of money in a restaurant, a convenience store and stuff like that.
In South Dakota, State Trooper Kevin Graben has been rescuing stranded drivers for the past 3 days in the blizzard. He says the storm caught a lot of people by surprise because it came relatively early in the season and it stayed for so long.
We have been pulling out approximately 20 to 25 cars an hour from ditches, stranded motorists. We've investigated approximately 10 accidents per hour while the traffic has been at its peak at times. Of course, it's the holidays, and we're getting some travelers from the southern area of the country, and they're coming into this storm system totally unprepared.
One bright spot for those southern visitors, the Dakotas are finally clearing as the storm pushes south and east. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Sedeklik in St. Paul.
Reverend Jesse Jackson called for an end to the consumer boycott of Texaco today, saying the oil giant had taken steps to improve minority employment and contracting. Jackson's comments came after Texaco released details of a plan to diversify its workforce and do more business with companies owned by women and minorities. Among other things, Texaco said it would triple the number of its retail outlets owned by blacks and increase the number of black and female managers it employs by 25%. The plan marks an attempt by Texaco to restore its image following allegations that executives tampered with evidence in a race discrimination case. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Texaco had promised to do all it could to improve race relations at the company when allegations of evidence tampering surfaced last month. Today, after a six-week review of the company's hiring and contracting policies, Chairman Peter Bijour described what the company would do. In some ways, the plan goes further than Texaco's critics had hoped for. Bijour outlined a series of mentoring and staff review programs designed to recruit, retain, and promote more minorities and women. He also said Texaco would greatly increase the amount of business it steered toward minority and women-owned companies. All this, he said, would be good for Texaco.
We can only benefit by drawing from a larger pool of suppliers and services because they bring a broader perspective, and therefore we will have a better understanding of the market in which we compete.
The release of the plan came 6 weeks after the New York Times reported that several Texaco executives had been caught on tape belittling blacks and Jews and discussing whether to destroy evidence sought in a race discrimination suit filed by employees. In the wake of the scandal caused by those revelations, one Texaco executive was charged with obstruction of justice, and some black leaders called for a company boycott. Meanwhile, the company rushed to settle the discrimination case at a total cost of $176 million and promised to improve the racial climate at the company. Chairman Bijour insisted that the plan unveiled today consisted of goals that would guide company policy, not quotas, which he said arbitrarily impose rigid results of dubious benefit.
Let there be no mistake within Texaco. We will not have quotas. We will continue to hire only the most capable people, and promotions will continue to be based on the merit of the candidate.
Nevertheless, Bijour attached some specific numbers to the goals. Texaco wants to increase its minority workforce from 23% to 29% by the year 2000 and expand the number of blacks it employs from 9% to 13% during the same period. The plan won qualified praise from several African-American leaders, including NAACP President Kwesi Mfume. Reverend Jesse Jackson praised what he called Bijour's courageous leadership in attempting to remedy present and past discrimination, and he called for an end to the boycott.
The Texaco is on a journey from tragedy to triumph. The journey is incomplete, but they have changed their course.
But Jackson also suggested that it was important now to monitor Texaco to ensure that it fulfills the promises it has made. This is Jim Zeroli in New York.
9% of all Americans are alcoholics or alcohol abusers, according to a government study on the treatment of alcoholism. Alcoholism is so serious, the National Institutes of Health has spent $27 million to identify the best ways to help alcoholics quit drinking. And the surprising result, therapy, based on the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step model, works as well as any other psychotherapy. And for some people, 12-step programs work best. Dr. Enoch Gordas is the director of the National Institute on Alcoholic Abuse and Alcoholism, which supervised the study. It is the most comprehensive investigation of its kind ever conducted. He joins us by telephone from his office in Rockville, Maryland. First of all, Dr. Gordas, could you tell us what it is about 12-step type programs that works best for some people?
The 12-step program, which is, of course, mostly identified now with Alcoholics Anonymous, encourages the patient to go through a series of steps. It regards alcoholism as a disease, and the patient is not at fault for having a character defect, and the patient is encouraged to work together with other patients within the AA movement in order to recover.
You also tested therapies in which you try to give people strategies to cope with the circumstances which lead them to drink, and you found that that worked pretty well.
That's right. The second of our therapy was the so-called cognitive behavioral approach, which comes from the whole tradition of learning theory and psychology. And the philosophy of this approach is that abusive drinking is a learned response to life stresses, and that the way to get better from this is to unlearn these habits of drinking in response to stress and to have alternate plans for dealing with them as they come up.
And then the other method you looked at was helping people to look within themselves for the resources to quit drinking, which you also found was effective.
That's right. That's called motivational enhancement. And unlike the AA 12-step approach, where patients are sort of guided and instructed to work through the AA steps, and unlike the cognitive behavioral one, where they're giving a kind of a lesson plan or recipes for dealing with stressful situations, the motivational enhancement arm of therapy did neither. It tapped into the patient's own motivation for change and encouraged that side of the patient's motivations so the patient would go out and find his or her own way to recover. But there was neither instruction nor inspiration here.
Now, the whole idea was based on the premise that if you could correctly identify the reasons why people drink, you could match them to the appropriate therapy and help them to stop drinking.
Yes, there was a good deal of evidence before this research began from smaller research programs and from the recommendations of the Institute of Medicine, for example, that we could increase the efficiency of treatment if we typed them according to certain personality and behavioral characteristics and matched them to one of these three arms of treatment, which were very different in their philosophy and therefore could be handled in a very distinct way. By and large, this prediction did not work out. The patients did about the same in all three arms of treatment, and they were all reasonably effective.
So if you found somebody who had a religious bent, you would sort of theorize that 12-step programs would work for them, or somebody who's everybody in their whole industry went out to drink every night, you figured that cognitive therapy would work for them, and none of that happened.
By and large, what you're saying is correct. Those kinds of reasonable hypotheses were not borne out by the results of the study.
So, Dr. Gordas, is the glass half empty or half full? I mean, what you found here is that you can't seem to pick a particularly effective way of treating an individual person, but on the other hand, all the ways you tried worked pretty well.
Well, I think one could say the glass is both half empty and half full. I agree with that completely. The good thing is that the drinking behavior of all the patients in all three arms of treatment improved markedly once they got into the treatment. I think this study has brought behavioral therapies to its finest level of analysis. I think the future now lies in looking to the new sciences of neuroscience and genetics to understand the brain mechanisms in craving and relapse, which will permit us to develop new pharmacological therapies which will complement the behavioral therapies which have been traditional.
Dr. Enoch Gordas is the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. He talked to us by telephone from his office in Rockville, Maryland. This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This year, Hollywood's Christmas season started earlier than it has in a decade. The competition for movie screens is so fierce that a number of films will be opening only in New York and Los Angeles and expanding to other cities when the Christmas rush is over. That's called platforming, and it's usually done to lend prestige to foreign films and Oscar nominees. This year, it is so widespread that when we asked Bob Mondello for a Christmas movie preview, he had to prepare three.
Let's start with what we'll all be able to see. If you live in a town with six or more movie screens, virtually every one of them is showing something relatively new right now. Maybe Tom Cruise in Jerry Maguire, or Whitney Houston in The Preacher's Wife, or Mars Attacks, and for sure, 101 Dalmatians. Within the next 2 weeks, everything else, all those Thanksgiving pictures that seemed like must-sees a couple of weeks ago, will be swept away in an onslaught of comedies. It starts this weekend with the arrival of three Odd Couples, none more maladjusted than the dysfunctional duo that arrives from MTV. Beavis and Butthead do America.
You can't do America. We're in a court.
We're gonna be movie stars.
There's gonna be shit, and we're gonna go to party. It's gonna get you. Ow!
Settle down, Beavis.
Beavis and Butthead Do America chronicles a cross-country trip that takes television's animated twerps from Las Vegas to the White House. Though it's only 75 minutes, it will no doubt seem much longer to parents, which is why Hollywood is also trotting out an Odd Couple trip to the White House for older folks. Much older folks, Jack Lemmon and James Garner, to be precise, playing former chief executives who hate each other but are forced to work together in My Fellow Americans, a film the trade has already dubbed Grumpy Old Presidents.
Let's stop talking. We're about to bomb. It'll make me vomit.
I was Time Magazine's Man of the Year.
So was Hitler.
Not twice.
A tamer battle is depicted in the romantic comedy One Fine Day, which also opens Friday across the country. It features Michelle Pfeiffer and ER's George Clooney as single parents who are juggling careers and children and who decide reluctantly to team up. Also hoping for laughter over the holidays is a slightly disreputable angel named Michael, played by John Travolta and directed by Nora Ephron. And all those movies, along with Wes Craven's latest horror flick, Scream, will be playing in literally thousands of theaters by Christmas Day, including one near you. If you live in a major metropolis, spirits of a more serious sort will also be arriving this month in Ghosts of Mississippi, Rob Reiner's drama about the frustrating three-decade march to justice for the killer of civil rights leader Medgar Evers. The film stars Whoopi Goldberg, Alec Baldwin, and as unrepentant racist Byron De La Beckwith, James Woods, in a performance that's sure to be remembered at Oscar time.
I would never kill a deer. A nigger, on the other hand, well, that's another matter entirely.
Are you standing here and admitting to me that you killed Medgar Evers?
What if I did? It's not like there's anything you nor anybody else can do about it. Yes, sir.
We're going to see about that.
Oh, that we will. That we will.
Joining Ghosts of Mississippi in major cities will be Arthur Miller's The Crucible, the story of a different sort of trial. Back in the 1950s, Miller's play about witch hunts that took place in colonial Massachusetts seemed a commentary on the anti-communist hearings of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Today, the impact is different, but no less chilling.
I have brought trouble on these people.
Not if they are of good conscience, Mr. Nurse. You misunderstand, sir. A person is either with this court or against it. There'd be no road between.
Also in major markets will be such long-awaited films as Evening Star, the sequel to Terms of Endearment, the latest from The Piano's director, Jane Campion, Portrait of a Lady, based on the novel by Henry James, and Milos Forman's The People vs. Larry Flint, which chronicles the colorful and controversial First Amendment battles fought by the founder of Hustler magazine.
They're afraid if they let you in the court, you're going to wear a diaper or throw oranges at the justices, and they should be, Larry, because in all the times you've gone to the court asking for help, you've never once demonstrated any respect for its institutions and procedures. So as far as they're concerned, you're just a pig.
Yeah, well, you always said, and it's the principle, a pig has the same rights as a president.
Yeah. That, you know, people get tired of a pig.
Add in the musical biography Shine, which has been setting records in limited runs and will go wide on Christmas Day, and the terminal illness comedy Marvin's Room, which stars Meryl Streep, Diane Keaton, and Leonardo DiCaprio, and that's quite a Christmas roster.
But this year, it's only about half the story, for if you live in New York or Los Angeles, another half dozen films are opening exclusive runs, and some of them are pretty commercial. Take the new Albert Brooks comedy, Mother, in which Brooks plays a recently divorced novelist who is convinced that his problems with women started with his mom, and that to fix them, he has to move back in with her.
I don't think every mother says, honey, you look good, but your hair is thinning.
I never told you your hair was thinning.
You called after me? Look out for your bald spot?
Oh, well, someone has to say that.
And here's to you, Mrs. Henderson. Your gross son is moving back today. Hey, hey, hey.
Debbie Reynolds plays the title role in Mother after 27 years away from the screen. Another actress who comes out of retirement to play mom to a grown man with family problems is Julie Christie, whose screen son has the most famous line in all of drama.
To be or not to be.
That is one of many questions that will be asked by Kenneth Branagh in the first full-length Hamlet ever brought to the screen. Shakespeare's play is almost always abbreviated in production since it runs for more than 4 hours in its entirety. Not this movie, though, so another question will be whether patrons can sit through it. To keep them interested, Branagh has assembled an all-star cast that includes Billy Crystal, Charlton Heston, John Gielgud, Richard Attenborough, Robin Williams, Jack Lemmon, and Gerard Depardieu. In a few months, this Hamlet will also be released in a cut-down 2.5-hour version for the faint of heart. Also on the longish side is the movie that makes the season's biggest fashion statement, Evita, the story of Argentina's Eva Perón and her flirtation with power and the House of Dior.
Don't cry for me, I will be I kept my promise, don't leave your distance.
While Madonna is banking on Evita to make her an Oscar contender, lesser lights like Herb Gardner and Kevin Spacey are making their directing debuts. Gardner with a screen version of his sentimental stage comedy, I'm Not Rappaport, and Spacey with the oddly titled crime drama, Albino Alligator. French filmmaker Claude Chabrol will also weigh in with a cautionary tale called The Ceremony that's guaranteed to make its New York and Los Angeles viewers very nervous about hiring a housekeeper. All of these films will roll out to the rest of the country in January, after the dust clears from this week's Battle of the Comedies, which should keep audiences busy until the first wave of next year's films, which includes the return of all three Star Wars movies, a sequel to Jurassic Park, and the big screen debut of Beaver Cleaver. Can you wait? I'm Bob Mondello.